Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. On the 26th of July 2021, I did a show with Chris of Patriotic Talk in the UK and his guys. This is the first time that I've dealt with them, and Chris used to work with a guy called Mark Collett. The main focus of interest was the violence in South Africa as a result of the Zuma riots and the racial issues that come from that. But later in the show, they also spoke about Britain and what they're doing, and they asked questions, especially about how to teach whites and what are the best strategies that can help in spreading the word and bringing people to our side. And we went through quite a number of points in that regard, and we spoke about racial unity, etc. So there are many things I don't know about British nationalism at the current time, and we have mentioned that we would get together again and talk some more. What I am happy about is that there are whites in Britain who are at least addressing some of the issues like race, etc. We spoke about race mixing and all sorts of other related things. I do want to come back to the Zuma riots at some point in the future to do a proper military analysis. But I've got another much more important military analysis that I'm busy with. With regard to the Zuma riots of July 2021, which is what we discuss in this show, I do want to look at a special military analysis for those events. We're going to look really closely at some things. This is very educational, and for whites in South Africa, this is stuff that is utterly useful for survival. Many incredible things took place in those early days of this extreme violence. Some really incredible things took place, and that stuff needs to be looked at very carefully. There will be many lessons, especially for whites in South Africa, but also for other whites who are feeling that one day they're going to be outnumbered, and there's plenty of opportunity for survival, regardless of the numbers. So, without further ado, here is the interview with Chris and his team at Patriotic Talk.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriotic Talk. How is everyone doing in the chat? Hope everyone's good. Interesting show ahead. Well, tomorrow we do have a special, probably an hour show, with Anglo Joe and someone else. I can't remember his name now. Richard Lumbey. That's it. Sorry, bro. Richard Lumbey used to be in the BNP. He's the founder of the INN. There's two jams in the chat now. I don't know what's going on there, but I'll give you a link here. We've got a chat room now, so if you can join the chat room and get involved, put your ideas forward. We're also on YouTube, so if you are struggling on DLive, it's over on Hemi's channel. If you want to put the link in DLive, bro, please join our channel, Independent Nationalist Network. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow. We have some interesting activism planned for this weekend, so please get involved tomorrow. Please put your ideas forward. Go and join our chat rooms and our channels. But let's go over and introduce everyone. First, we'll go to you, Hemi. Welcome to the show, bro. How are you?
Oh, too bad, you.
Yeah, very well. Thank you, mate. It's good to have you here. You had a good weekend.
Good, good. Yeah, still more nice weather.
Yeah, it's been boiling today. I'm sweating cobs.
Yeah, yeah.
Marcian, how are you, bro?
Yeah, I'm all good, mate. Yourself?
Very well, mate. Very well. It's good to be here. Good guest ahead. We had a good chat, our chat, me and Marcian, with him on Saturday. So let's introduce him. Jan, how are you today, mate?
I'm fine, thanks, and you?
Oh, there you go.
It's a pleasure and honour to be on your show.
welcome to the show. So,
did you hear me?
Yeah, well, heard you fine, mate. Yeah. Just for those that maybe not unsure a bit about yourself, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, who you are, and where people can find your work?
Okay, my name is Jan Lamprecht. My main website where you can find my work is historyreviewed.com, and I have a smaller website for South Africa called africancrisis.info. And do you want me to give a bit of a background about myself?
Yeah, okay. Give yourself a background. I'll put the links in the dialogue chat for you.
Okay, very, very basically, my parents are Boers. They were Afrikaans people from South Africa who moved from South Africa to the British colony of Rhodesia in 1947. And it is there that I was born. In the 60s, and I grew up there during the time of the Bush War, when blacks were fighting the whites for power. And when that came to an end and we lost power, I and the rest of my family moved to South Africa in 1980. Two-thirds of the whites of Rhodesia left Rhodesia to come to leave within this. Very few were willing to live under black communist rule. I lived in South Africa. I got into computers and I stayed out of politics and I kept my nose away from politics all through my time in South Africa until the year 2000. In 2000, when Robert Mugabe started going after the white farmers in Zimbabwe, and he was destroying them, that was the point where I couldn't keep my mouth shut anymore. And that is when I actually started to become an activist. And my biggest thing then was to tell people to, I wanted to warn the whites of South Africa specifically that that's the future for white South Africa, and white South Africans had better get ready. We're going to lose everything and they're going to take it by force. And of course, while I was on the internet, I also tried to then spread the message to Americans and anyone else I could come across to tell them that when you hear all this talk about democracy in Africa and Southern Africa and everything is happy and all that, that's nonsense. Southern Africa is ruled by black communists. Black commies are in charge, and they even steal elections, do whatever they want to do. So don't you believe that liberal claptrap. So that's my sort of...
I'm lagging out a bit here.
That's how I got going. And then after that, I got involved later. As a result of... people on my website, I later learned more about the Jews and World War II, and that was another another step from there to History Reviewed.
So Jan, before you come on, you mentioned that there's a break in development in South Africa that involves speech laws. Could you go into that, what you were telling us before we come live?
Yes, that's very important. I thought I'd mention it right now because this afternoon I was talking to my attorney because we're due back in court on Thursday anyway, because that's for a case that involves Jews who laid a bunch of charges against me a year ago. And the event on Thursday should be hopefully the end of the case and we'll see what the outcome is. But while I was talking to my attorney raised the issue of the hate speech laws. And I've known about the hate speech laws for quite a long time. I did a show about them 4 years ago when I did it with Dr. Peter Hammond, who's also from South Africa, but he was also living in Rhodesia. Peter Hammond basically said that in about 2017, he said that the Jews of South Africa and the gays have kicked off a set of hate speech laws. He referred to them as draconian hate speech laws, and that these things are coming. Last year, an attorney told me that I would not be able to survive and function once these things come. With my current attorney, I was talking to him today, and he said the same thing to me. And to give you an idea of how bad this is going to be, his estimate is that it will come in probably in the next 6 months. The parliament's been busy with it now for quite a long time, and there is a lot of pushback, but you must know the pushback is not so much from the non-whites, but this thing's going to be very, very nasty. The way it's going to work is like this. Currently, in legal terms, if somebody accuses you of something or they say you engaged in hate speech, etc., then when you're in court, etc., they have to look at the context of what was said and, you know, why did you say it, etc., etc. There are other factors that are taken into account. But in these new hate speech laws, it's going to be totally different. There are two aspects to it. The one is personal and the other one is groups. Oh boy, and you can bet that there are certain groups who shall not be named, certain groups who are dying to use this stuff. And so now if you say or write anything, and it doesn't even have to be on the internet, it can be on any social media, it can be on phones, it can be face-to-face, it can be anything. You go and you're busy talking to somebody. It can even be at your work, you talking to your employee or you, the employee, talking to your boss. Somebody can just make a remark, and the person who feels that it's hate speech, that person can go to the police and lay charges, criminal charges of hate speech against you. And it doesn't matter what context it was, whether it was phones, private, face-to-face, internet, email, websites, you name it. You can lay these charges and then the state can come after you. And what the state will do is the definition of hate speech is not going to take into account any other contextual factors. It's only going to be based on the person who feels that it's hate speech. And the punishment for this is going to be draconian. In South Africa, there was a famous sportsman who murdered his girlfriend, and he got 7 years jail time for murder. Well, for hate speech, you'll be able to get 10 years jail time.
What, 10 years? So, but what would they class 10 as hate
years
speech?
For
What would they class as hate speech in South Africa?
Well, that's the nasty part about it, is that hate speech will be whatever your accuser says is hate speech. So if your accuser says that let's say, for example, someone talks to me and I say to them, you're a pig. And that person decides to take me to court for calling them a pig, and they say, oh, that is hate speech. Then
yeah, we have the same in the UK. We have the same in the UK. They can they've used it before when it comes to sexism and race. Right? If someone else feels offended on someone else's behalf, they can also charge you. But the amount of time that you're going to be done for in South Africa, 10 years, yeah, that's not. That's not the case in England, right? You probably get like a slap on the wrist and called in. So, yeah, 10 years, that seems very, very excessive.
Do you think there'll be more favoritism towards the blacks, though? If they said a hurty word against a white person, do you think they would get that sort of treatment? 10 years.
Well, it will obviously depend. It will obviously depend on how they implement it. But my understanding is that 10 years will be the maximum sentence. So it could obviously be less, but you don't know how they're going to rule. And we're still waiting to see. My attorney promised that the next time he gets the updates on the hate speech he will let me have it. And because we need to come back to this topic. This topic could silence. This topic is so nightmarish that it will put lots of people in danger. He said to me, once this goes in, he'll even just get off Facebook himself. He said he won't even talk to people on the phones, because anything you say to anybody, if they want to make a problem out of it, you're in trouble. So it's nasty.
In the courts, as Dion's asked this question, are the courts in South Africa biased towards blacks over white people?
You know, that is a bit of a complicated thing, but in certain respects, now you ask me a question. There are many things, it's a complicated question, but there are many things that are taken into account where blacks are let off the hook, or things are easier for them, because there are ways in which life is easier for them. They are allowed to get away with certain things that whites wouldn't, that you wouldn't be able to normally get away with. The way the law is applied in South Africa is not quite the same as the way it would be applied in a Western country like where you are, because the culture of the blacks is taken into account. And when they do that, that includes their violence and stuff and all kinds of other problems that they have. Those things are kind of overlooked. And there are many things that work for them, yes.
So speaking of violence, Jan, and when I watched your videos previously, right, you were going into like how the different ethnic groups amongst the blacks are in different groups and have somewhat been falling out over what's been going on in South Africa. Could you go into that a little bit, please?
Yes. The thing that you need to understand about Africa in general as compared to, say, America, where in America the blacks are just the blacks. In Africa is a lot more like Europe in the sense that blacks are tribes. So in Africa, for example, there are something like 54 countries, but there are more than 300 tribes. So what you have is you have multiple tribes living in an African country, and these tribes have got historical differences. And the other thing is, in Africa, like in Europe, the tribes often speak different languages. So you have that comparison is a pretty valid comparison. And so even their culture can differ. So when you get to literally any African country, has got two or more tribes in it. South Africa is actually the most diverse of all the countries in Africa. We've got 11 official languages, of which two are European, the one being English and the other one being Afrikaans. All the other 9 languages are from other tribes. So you've got all kinds of tribes that live in different parts of South Africa. And by the way, just as a fact of history, when the whites came to South Africa, when the original whites came to the Cape Colony, the blacks themselves had not even reached the southern tip of South Africa. Blacks and whites actually met. I think the whites had been in Africa like more than a century. It was like 160 years before the two groups physically ran into each other. Of course, they knew about each other because of hunters and explorers and so forth, but they physically came into contact about 160 years or so after the whites first came. They met at the Great Fish River in the Eastern Cape, the blacks coming down from the north. And there are also parts of South Africa that didn't have blacks. So a thing about Southern Africa and Africa south of the equator is that blacks are colonizers too. The blacks that you see in Southern Africa actually all come from West Africa. They come from like Nigeria and West Africa. They are colonizers. It's taken them 2,000 years to get here. But anyway, these groups that exist, these different tribes that exist, they got different backgrounds, different animosities, and even hatreds for each other. They fought each other, etc. And when apartheid existed, and the liberals and communists and Jews were all busy trying to gather the blacks together, the non-whites together against the whites, they tried to bring everybody together as a single front, and that included other non-whites like Indians and coloreds. Coloreds are mixed race. Coloreds are mixed race people. And the Indians that we've got are Indians that were brought into South Africa from India as slaves by the British. And this violence that took place recently occurred in the area known as KwaZulu-Natal. It's the province of KwaZulu-Natal. And Natal used to be a British colony. South Africa is composed of basically four different countries that were brought together by the whites and the British. They are the colony of Natal, the colony of the Cape, and then the two Boer republics, the Transvaal and the Free State. Those four sort of white-controlled nations were formed into the state of South Africa. And then the non-whites that were under their control were then part of that. But these non-whites were brought together, and the enemy were the whites. So they managed, it took them quite a while because it wasn't easy to get them all to cooperate. But the ruling party of South Africa, Nelson Mandela's party, which is called the ANC, the African National Congress, the ANC is dominated by a tribe known as the Khoisas. And the Khoisas come from down in the southeastern corner of South Africa. And the Khoisas were the main group in this time. They managed to get Indians in, Jews in, coloreds in, etc., and so forth. But they particularly struggled with the Zulus. The Zulus are a warrior tribe, and there was a time when the Zulus had something like an empire for a while. For about 10 years or so, they had something of an empire. And the Zulus actually were the ones, they are the biggest tribe in the country, and because they're more warlike and independent, they don't like being shunted around by others. So there was a big struggle to get the Zulus into the ANC. The German government, the West German government in the 1960s, actually decided to support the Zulus. And they actually gave money to a particular Zulu. And they were hoping that he would be an anti-communist, pro-Western future leader, but he actually was quite a weak fellow. He was pretty weak and kind of useless, and he didn't really make that much headway. But for quite a time, these Zulus resisted, and later on, the whites of South Africa, under apartheid, even armed the Zulus against the ANC. They actually fought against the ANC. There was like a miniature black-on-black civil war that people don't really know about. But anyway, yes?
Am I right in thinking that the Zulus are the Malemba and the EFF, and that would be the political party they're aligned with, or is that incorrect?
No, that's wrong. The EFF is from a guy called Malema. Malema is not a Zulu. Malema is a Pedi, and it's not a very well known tribe. And I don't even. But Malema's a hardcore communist. Anyway, so what happened was there was a Zulu by the name of Jacob Zuma who joined the ANC, and he was he actually ran the intelligence department of the ANC in a neighboring state, and he actually did very well in the ANC. So here you had this lone Zulu who was in this Khoza organization, but he was very loyal and he did everything that he needed to do, and he actually rose in this Khoza organization. And when Nelson Mandela came to power, he had two vice presidents. One was a guy called Mbeki, and the other was a guy called Zuma, the same Zuma. And what happened with Zuma is that later on, as Zuma rose through the ranks, the Zulus, Zuma was able to convince Zulus to come to the ANC. And so Zuma is a very special guy because he almost single-handedly is responsible for bringing Zulus into the ANC. And so that sort of completed the situation. You had half the Zulus supporting Zuma and the ANC and the other half fighting against the ANC. But Zuma is a very important character, and that is how they managed to finally get the Zulus on board.
All right, can we move forward to the
areas of South Africa has the trouble been happening that we've been witnessing onto the TV?
The main trouble has been in Natal, especially around the main city of Durban. The next place where the trouble moved to was here in, they call it Gauteng, but it's really the Johannesburg, Pretoria area, mainly the Johannesburg area, which is where I live. That is the next place where there was violence in certain areas, but not everywhere. So Johannesburg was not affected like Durban. Durban was like a freaking war zone. Durban and the smaller towns around Durban was like a freaking war zone. Johannesburg had it in a couple of townships, and I've only seen some film footage from one suburb where whites live in the eastern part, but it was attacks on shops, not attacks on the residents of the suburb. But the vast majority of the violence was all in Natal.
Was the majority of violence black on black, and how much of the violence was done on the whites?
Okay, the violence that took place recently was because of the arrest of Jacob Zuma for contempt of court. In a very brief nutshell, Zuma got into, he was the vice president, and then Mbeki became the president. But Mbeki was very friendly to liberals and Jews and so forth. And at a point, Mbeki started trying to change the way the political party works. In South Africa, the way the political system actually works is that the ruling party, the ANC, doesn't operate alone. It is part of a three-part structure. There is the South African Communist Party, which is a valid political party. The South African Communist Party, the ANC, and a big communist trade union called COSATU. Those three organizations work together in a formal alliance known as the Tripartite Alliance. And this is how they fought against whites during apartheid, and this is how they ruled the country. Now, what happened was when Mbeki was the president and Zuma was the vice president, Mbeki was getting very friendly to liberals and business people and so forth. And Mbeki tried to suddenly start taking the ANC away from the tripartite alliance. And this is where the original fight with Zuma came in. And so Mbeki fired his vice president, who was this Zulu called Zuma. And he fired him, and Zuma actually went and he said to them, look, I've done nothing wrong, and this guy is breaking all the rules. And then the communists realized that out of and he's actually trying to sideline all of them and sort of break the ANC away. Anyway, the communists backed Zuma and they had a conference, and the ruling party threw out Mbeki and put the communists came and they put Zuma in power, and that was wonderful for the commies, with a guy called Ramaphosa be Zuma's vice president. And the next thing you know is he's the president and Zuma's out, and now he's also charges against Zuma for corruption and all that kind of stuff. But rest assured that what Ramaphosa is doing to Zuma is no different to what Mbeki was doing to Zuma. And so what this does is this brings about a lot of new splits. And so in a nutshell, this violence that you're seeing, as well as this infighting at a high level in politics, what you are actually seeing is the ruling party of South Africa splitting apart into factions and starting to fight each other. And so we've got the Ramaphosa faction and the Zuma faction, and who knows, there might even be other factions to come. But it's a power struggle for control of the ruling party. Now, another thing about Ramaphosa is that Ramaphosa is also another weird tribe. He comes from the Vendas. But Ramaphosa might actually be a black who converted to Judaism. This is something that I've done videos about, and I explain the reasons why I believe that Ramaphosa is a black Jew. But anyway, so that's yet another twist, because you'll see that Ramaphosa is fated by the rich and the super rich. They're all behind him. The quotes, white Jews are his big buddies, etc. Money is behind him big time. And so that's another twist, which itself might result yet in other problems later down the line. So anyway, so the reason that Zuma was arrested was because and Zuma was saying that there's this conspiracy against him. And so all that happened was that at a point he didn't pitch up to court. He was in contempt of court, and eventually they decided to arrest him. But they know that Zuma has power, and the communists and this time the war veterans sided with Zuma, and they said, no, you're not allowed to put him in jail. And they've even made public demands about Zuma, and they said that if they put him in jail, they're going to make trouble. And this trouble that broke out was organized by high-level Zuma supporters, people with power, and they unleashed this violence. Now, when they unleashed this violence, They actually specifically, they even stated what they were, why they were unleashing it and who they were unleashing it against. They pointed out that the wealthy were Ramaphosa's supporters, the very rich, you know, the very rich whites, very rich Jews, and also the Indians. The Indians are also business people, and they are also very wealthy. So when they unleashed this violence, they specifically targeted the wealthy, actually, and they attacked the Indians, and then they tore down shopping malls, warehouses, smashed businesses, etc. They looted them, and then they set them on fire. I'm told that they may even have totally destroyed the industrial portion of Durban. The blacks also were going to attack whites, but the attempts to attack the whites seem to have been quite a flop. But the vast majority of the initial of the activity was aimed at businesses and the wealthy. The damage was tremendous. They damaged between 40 and 45,000 businesses, damaged or wiped out 40 to 45,000 businesses. The damage was, the last I heard, was 50 billion rands worth of damage, which in US dollars is 3.4 billion US dollars. This was done in 9 days or less. And in actual fact, if you look at the actual amount of damage done per day, there were some days that were very quiet. They did most of the damage in a period of 3 or 4 days. And they probably put at least 100,000 people out of work. But the damage is massive, massive infrastructure damage. Then they did try to attack whites and Indians. They, to my knowledge, from all my hunting and talking to people, I have not yet come across a single instance of a white who was killed. In total, 337 people died during the violence. But of those 337, I think 90 to 95% of those were blacks. And it was, and they managed to kill a couple of Indians. And that seems, it doesn't look like they managed to kill more than a couple of Indians, maybe a colored. But all in all, they didn't kill many. The vast majority of the people who died were blacks, but that is because there were people fighting back against them, etc. From what I've been able to establish, in the north of Durban is an Indian township from the time of. A lot of these townships and suburbs that were set up during apartheid still have very much the same populations that they had in the times of apartheid. So there was this township called Phoenix, and more than 80% of the people who live in Phoenix are Indians. And most Indians in South Africa are also Muslims, most of them. The blacks attacked Phoenix, and the most blacks that were killed in one place was actually in Phoenix. The blacks are now complaining that there was a thing called the Phoenix Massacre, and the Phoenix Massacre was simply Indians shooting back at blacks, but they also cut the blacks up. I came across mentioned that when the police went around Phoenix, they found 45 bodies in the bush around Phoenix. Some had gunshot wounds. Some of the blacks died of gunshot wounds. Some of the blacks died of pangas. A panga is a machete. Some of them died of panga wounds, and some died of gunshot and panga wounds. But the Indians actually fought back, and despite a couple of Indians being killed, the Indians actually killed the most blacks there, and they now complain about it, and they say, oh, it's the Phoenix Massacre and blah, blah, blah. But blacks also tried to set fire to some of the farms, to some white farms. I believe quite a lot of farms had damage from these fires. The setting fire to farms is an old thing. Blacks have been doing it for quite a few years now, where they start enormous fires in different parts of the country to burn down farms. There was one farm in Natal where they had to airlift the farmer and his family out by helicopter because they were surrounded by fires. They couldn't get out. But on the whole, the whites did quite well, and I'll just finish off. The whites came out with their security companies and with their neighborhood watchers, and they fought back and blocked off the blacks. They also teamed up with Indian security companies and Indian neighborhood watchers. And all in all, it looks like the fight back to hold the blacks out of the suburbs, especially the white suburbs, looks like it was totally successful.
So when I was listening to you before on Surviving While America, you were saying that it's the first time really there's been troubles between the Indians and blacks, and how that this could be a good thing for whites. Could you go into that a little bit, please?
Okay. The blacks in Africa... In Africa, you have a problem between blacks and Indians in a number of parts of Africa. It's very similar to the dynamic between whites and Jews, where you get the Indians becoming very wealthy, and then the blacks start getting irritated by these Indians. Now, in other parts of Africa, blacks have been physically, Indians have been physically chased out of countries like Zambia, which was the British colony of Northern Rhodesia, Tanzania, they chased out Indians. So there is a time where Indians and blacks start running into serious trouble. And the first time that there was trouble between the Zulus and the Indians, so keep in mind that most of the Indians live in Natal because that is where the British brought them as slaves, and most of them still live there. But the Zulus and the Indians had something of a clash in 1949. The Zulus grew tired of the way that the Indians were treating them, and one day a Indian said something to a black child, and it started kicking off some anger among the Zulus, and the Zulus got more and more angry, and the Zulus started attacking the Indians, and they said that they're going to kill all the Indians. Anyway, the whites came in, and the whites shot the Zulus and beat the Zulus and so on, and the whites came in, and the whites crushed the Zulu attempts at genocide of the Indians in 1949. But the Indians themselves were helpless and were not able to fight back and didn't fight back. It was the whites who saved the Indians from genocide. However, now in this set of events that's happened here, and also, by the way, during the time of apartheid, when they were trying to gather together a front against the whites, the Indians who owned farms and businesses in Natal openly allowed their black workers to deal with the ANC and the Communist Party and so forth. So relations between the Indians and the Zulus and the blacks in general improved, because the whites were the enemy. But now, for the first time ever in South African history, the Indians have actually had weapons, and they actually started killing blacks. And like I say, they killed a lot more blacks than the few losses that they suffered. So this is an absolute first, not only in the history of South Africa, but probably in Africa, where Indians have actually militarily, with killed and defeated and smashed blacks. Now, by the way, the blacks who were coming and looting, most of them just came, they weren't armed, so they didn't come with AK-47s and stuff. But of course, hidden among them were people who had more nefarious deeds to do, like arson and so on. And there were a couple of instances where there were armed people among those blacks. But generally speaking, it looks like 95% of the blacks, 95 or more percent of the blacks, were not armed with weapons. So these are unarmed blacks, but they're looking for crime, and they're coming to do their wild thing. And some of them may have had spears and may have had pangas. That's possible. And very few would have had weapons. But anyway, so in terms of armament, the Indians were much better armed, and the Indians went after them, and the Indians killed a lot of them. They hunted them down and killed them. In the massacre known as the Phoenix Massacre, it's at least 50 killed, but we will still see in time to come what the real numbers are. Like I say, there are 337 dead people, 95% of them are blacks, and we will with time start finding out how many were killed, who and who killed them. Because it's not blacks who killed blacks. The police came, the police were useless, the police came in late, the army came in the latest and did the least. The police were the next group that did some shooting. And remember that the police as well as the security companies do not just go out and use live ammunition. Okay. When I was a kid in Rhodesia, the law of the land was that in the case of looting, that you would be shot dead on sight by the police. That is not how the law is in South Africa. You are not allowed to do that. You can only shoot under very limited conditions. Your life has to be seriously in danger before you're allowed to shoot. So security companies, neighborhood watches, even the police, they got to back down and they got to retreat and they got to do all kinds of other things before they do shooting. Shooting is very much a last resort. So another thing you must keep in mind is that if the whites really wanted to shoot, the death toll could have been 10 times greater or 20 times greater. But because of the law, etc., everyone was restrained to the maximum. So, but even so, 337 are dead. Anyway, the fact that the Indians, for the first time ever, openly fought and killed Zulus is a first. And the Zulus are so pissed off about this. And their warrior pride is also hurt. And I've seen messages that Zulus sent where they said they're not going to forget this. So now we're back to a situation than 1949. Sorry to interrupt there.
But are the Zulus now going to take revenge against the Indians? Do you not think there's going to be a massive riot, big revenge attack against the Indian people for what they've done to the Zulus in the upcoming weeks or months?
I don't think we're going to see big things. I think that what you're likely to see in the future in terms of revenge is much smaller, more imperceptible things. They will go, they will start committing crimes against them. They will quietly start murdering some of them, etc. It'll be like the farm murders. It'll be something that happens quietly, and then Indians will say, you know, that was very funny. Did you notice this and this? And that guy's dropped dead and so on. It'll be something along those lines. These kinds of big actions, like you've seen, they're going to be rare, and you're not likely to see something like this again for a very long time. And also, whatever will happen now, because the police and the army and the security and the private security companies are now sort of on red alert, and everybody's watching the Zuma camp, the Zuma camp will have to change its tactics.
tactics and try and do things in a different way. So I suspect that a lot of stuff will be much more low key. These blacks, when they fight each other, they also quietly murder each other here and there. I think it'll be something like that. I don't think you'll easily see a thing like this again. Not for many years.
Hemen, do you want to ask anything?
Yeah. I've got a bit of a bit of a. I'm going to butcher this guy's name. I'm sorry, Jan. Someone in my chat says to ask you about Hendrik Verwoerd, the South African PM who was assassinated in the late 60s. Do you think that event affected current South Africa?
Ah, I actually did a video about Hendrik Verwoerd. Verwoerd is a fascinating character. He was known as the architect of apartheid. Verwoerd was basically trying to implement apartheid. Basically, apartheid was nothing more than what is it that the Americans had? Segregation.
Segregation.
Apartheid, in a nutshell, was more than segregation, but Verwoerd tried to also do it in various ways that would take some of the heat off of the whites of South Africa. So what they even did at a point was they took chunks of territory and made it independent black states and gave blacks actual countries with a parliament, with a police force, with a constitution, with voting rights and everything. And then they'd say, okay, this is an independent country. And legally, by South African definition, it was independent. Verwoerd, as a rule, Verwoerd undercover, the real Verwoerd. I did a video about the fact that Verwoerd was a closet national socialist. So he was a closet Nazi, and he also detested the Jews. And I did a whole video about the Jewish role in the killing of Verwoerd. This is a totally closed thing. This is a thing that has been hidden away for decades, and I did a video about it a couple of months ago. There was a Jewish communist who was the main mastermind behind all the assassination attempts on Verwoerd. Verwoerd basically was trying to split South Africa up and to see to it that the whites had important chunks of territory for themselves and that the whites could be a functioning group. And Verwoerd worked very hard for all whites to stick together. He was very much a racialist. He wanted the Afrikaans and the English to come together and to try and forget the Boer War and all the bad stuff of the past, and that whites must stick together as whites. And he even went to great lengths to lure the English and British whites to team up with the Boers so that everybody, all whites, own South Africa. Verwoerd tried to do a lot of good things from a white racial perspective. And by the way, Verwoerd was born in Holland. So he's actually a guy who wasn't even born in South Africa. But he was an awesome guy, and he did great until they assassinated him. They hated him. Jews, liberals, communists, they hate Verwoerd more than any other white leader in the history of South Africa. They hate him like crazy.
Jan, sorry to interrupt. Do you know much about what's going on in England at all? Do you have much bearings on what's going on here politically and with immigration levels? Just for our England audience, so we could talk a little bit about England as well. Do you have any idea the problems we face at the moment? And do you go on?
I have a little bit of an idea of what goes on. And it does interest me because always me. My understanding is that immigration problem, and I've noticed that you've had Pakistanis and Nigerians. You even had an influx of Zimbabweans at one point. And your empire, what used to be your empire, is coming to you. You're being colonized by your empire. But I don't know the deeper parts of your politics. I know some people have been trying to do activism. I know you've got very nasty laws there. I've been in touch. The main person I've been in touch with is Alison Chablot, who is now in jail. And I hope she should be out any, I would imagine. So I'd love to hear more.
Okay. Well, at the moment, I think we, what was the net migration, Hemi? Was it
300,000?
Just over 300,000. So in terms of going in and out, there's 300,000 per year or on average, something like that.
We got 700,000 out, 400,000 in. As for the laws, I mean, we have more like weird laws. We have the non-crime hate incident, which, although it's not a crime and you're not arrested or charged or anything for it, it stays on your record. So if anyone, so if you work for a firm that does a criminal records check, then that stays on there, which it, we just have like weird laws, I think.
And at the last demographic check, which was in 2011, we were 80% British. The next census is due out this year, and most people are predicting we're going to be around 73% British. And there was a professor called David Coleman who'd done the study, and he's predicting by 2066 that will be the point when Britain will be less than 50% British. So time is at the essence for us as well.
Yeah, exactly. And what's happening at the every single day, Shant, record numbers are coming in through boats on dinghies from France to the United Kingdom and to a place called Dover. So but they're doing nothing about it. They're being put up in like fancy hotels, like 4 or 5 star hotels, while we have veterans living homeless on our streets.
What's interesting about that as well, when they're coming over on the dinghies, right, is there's a company called Serco that are heavily involved in it. They've actually got the contracts for the surveillance of the coastline, for prisons to be built, for the housing to be built. And the interesting thing to that company is the CEO of the company is Winston Churchill's grandson, so great grandson. So that's interesting.
Oh wow! You know, Winston Churchill's grandson. He featured time. I'm not sure if he came to Rhodesia or something at some point, but that
his name is Richard Somers.
That guy. So you got
I thought his grandson was Nicholas Somers.
Is it Nick? I think it's Richard Somers. Sure it is. But yeah, but he's other, he has another grandson, right?
Non-whites coming in every year is a lot.
Yeah, I mean that's just legal ones, right? That's the ones that's the ones that we know about. There's probably another 20 to 30 thousand people we don't. No, I'm sorry, Chris.
I was just saying, like, what some days like that, Steve Laws is down there. Reports sometimes like 100 migrants have come in, 200 migrants have come in through the boats. And they literally, the border force is just there. There's coaches waiting for them, and they just get drove off to hotels across the country. Whoever will take them. To be fair, we actually exposed the hotel last year on live on the show. Actually, so I rang up and said, I'm from Serco, who you just mentioned, and I said, look, I've got 15 migrants fresh off the boat. Can we bring them to your hotel? Do you have room? And they said, yeah. Then obviously I made a little joke, which you will not get, Jan, but the lads will. I said, well, let's make them feel English at home. Give them a cheese sandwich and a curly whirly. He said, the kitchen's closed. I said, well, you know, maybe fix them up. Maybe order a curry in or something like that, I said. And then I had a friend straight after say, look, I'm in the area. You're 5 minutes away from me. I'm stranded with my family. Can I have a room for the night? And they said, no, we're not open. We're not open. So that's how we exposed them, and it was live on the show. But over to you.
Another question I had about South Africa, Jan, and the whites in South Africa. As things get worse and worse for the whites, do you see the, more and more whites being liberal?
No ways. No ways. No. That is the thing that I've seen about the way things progress, is that in many ways, white people don't really get afraid easily. They are put to sleep by liberal propaganda. But as whites start waking up, and the worse things get, the more things come to your door, the more whites will change. I have seen this over and over again. And that's why I say, why I'm an accelerationist. I say worse is better. Let the worst come. And the sooner and faster it comes, the better. Even in South Africa, I've said if the blacks want to race war, let them attack us tomorrow. They can attack without warning. You will immediately see how the whites will respond. And the events in Durban have proven what I've said totally true, that in an instant, the whites are all nice and quiet, and then when the trouble comes, in an instant, they start doing things immediately. And I reckon that worse is better. Let the non-whites pour into your country, let them murder more people, rape more women, and do stuff. That is the thing that's going to wake whites up. And I thought when COVID came, I thought COVID was definitely because it's so weird and it's going to affect everybody with these lockdowns. And I've been very pleased with what COVID has done. I've never seen so much white activism ever. And I think that as your white population starts falling, and you have more and more of these people, and you lose jobs, and you lose power, and you start losing political control of your country, and non-whites are telling you what Britain should be like and how Britain should be run, and doing is going to be the greatest thing. And I think that that. The only way that you're going in terms of immigration making countries non-white, is it going to be a slower process in Europe?
Is it cut out for everyone, or is it just me?
I can't hear anyone. It was quiet.
So I heard the end of what you said. It's going to be slow, right? When the immigration is coming in and in. One thing I've noticed in the UK, though, a lot of the working class, especially females, tend to do the race mixing, which the mainstream obviously push on them by using propaganda, right? Is that a big problem within South Africa but amongst the whites, or is there not much race mixing going on?
It's actually quite amazing that in South Africa, despite the situation, that the race mixing is not anything like what you would have thought. It happens, but it's very little. It's in terms of like formal marriages, they are very rare between whites and non-whites. Even among the, do you know that even among the non-whites, they also have their own racial codes? The Indians, for example, are the most racist of all the non-whites. Indians almost never date and marry outside their group. The blacks, of course, are keen to get involved with anybody, but in reality, how much of it turns into formal marriage is not a big thing. In terms of men and women, it's actually probably more the men do.
Hello, you unprofessional idiot. Sorry, he's our local. We just have him on for a comedian effect. Sorry, Jan.
Okay. And I noticed that in America that the girls are pushed heavily into race mixing, and it sounds to me like in the case of the white girls, it's like peer pressure. The liberals are using peer pressure to get the girls to do race mixing because girls are more susceptible to peer pressure. But in South Africa, there is still a certain kind of racism underneath even the most liberal whites, and it's extremely rare for whites to marry non-whites. Very rare.
Jan, did you ever see Lauren Southern's documentary at all in South Africa? I think it was called Borderlands. Did you ever see that?
I've heard of it, and I probably only watched a few minutes, but I didn't go into – I didn't watch the whole thing, no. But
I can't really ask much about it. Obviously, not an enjoyable documentary. It was quite sad to see so many white farmers going through such brutality. I know we spoke about this off stream, but can you talk to us a little bit about the white farmers and what's going on and some of the brutality tactics that these people are using against the white farmers?
Okay. The first time that I heard of farm murders was late in the 1990s already. And it was something that nobody even knew existed. And then suddenly in quarters, people were starting to talk about farmers had already been killed and nobody had even heard about it. Then when I got onto my activism with regard to Robert Mugabe attacking the farmers in Zimbabwe, when I got into that, I then started writing more and talking about farm murders in South Africa. And it was myself and an ex-South African lady in Holland. We were the only two that were ever mentioning farm murders. And then I went and hunted for farm murder photos. And I because Americans, many of my visitors to my website were Americans. And they would say to me, "You're just making this stuff up. This can't be real. The blacks don't really go and kill white farmers. You're just talking shit." So I went and I got more and more photos and I set up a farm murders page. But later, liberals actually shut my website down just for my farm murders page and citing it specifically. But I published all these photos of what had happened to white farmers, men, women, children, and that helped to get
sorry to interrupt there. Your connection seems to be cutting out quite a bit. I don't know if you can do anything about that.
What I could maybe do, if you'll give me 30 seconds, is I'll switch to another connection and we see if that connection is more stable.
I thought it was my connection. Yeah, no worries. I'm going to have a little switch.
I'll do it now.
All right, thank you. Sorry, I thought it was my connection playing up, but there's been a few comments in the chat there. So sorry about that, guys.
Well, as you were saying about the race mixing propaganda, it's even going on over here. Oh, that's better. I can even.
Hello. Is it better?
Oh, that's much better. Maybe we'll have to start the show again. We're just going to end it and do another 2 hour show. But yeah, that's much better, mate. That's much better. Sorry, carry on. Hemi, what was you going to say first? One sec, yeah.
I was just going to say the race mixing propaganda, it's everywhere, isn't it? I mean, we see it over here now. I mean, you'd think from our adverts that England was like 75% black if you watched the TV.
Oh, it's everywhere. I actually went, when I done probably my actually last piece of activism for PA, actually. I met this old couple and I asked them about it. This old guy was disgusted. He was like, I have to record everything now. So I have to, obviously he loves his Emmerdales and Coronation Streets, typical boomer. You won't get this, obviously, Jan, with these programs, but he records everything now just so he can forward warn the adverts because it's just so in your face. And obviously the pro-LGBT stuff and whatnot.
What's unique about in the UK, right, is where you do get certain groups that segregate off, but a lot of the blacks live amongst the whites on, like, in the working class areas, especially on the council estates. So that's why you've seen it more in areas, from what I've seen in my day-to-day life.
I thought they'd done the stats and it was like 4% of like people are in a interracial relationship.
I mean, I was looking at my local area the other day by the school system, and there's actually a more mixed English and Jamaican kids at the school than there is Jamaican kids at the school, which is interesting. So the Jamaicans are being being bred out as well in England, right? It's a problem amongst them. You hear a lot of their women actually complaining about this quite a lot, with the black men going with white women.
Yeah, of course. But if you look at the media, like, it's literally portrayed as black man, white woman, in 9 times out of 10, that's how it's portrayed. You know, when I went to school with girls, man, I would love a mixed race baby. They're so cute, and they've been drilled into believing like themselves. White people are bad, evil people. You know, like, even when we ran, got that Ian Lee last week, and the girl next to him, the white girl's like, oh, are they going to decline? I'm for the decline of the white people. You know, like, they're literally born and raised to hate themselves and all white people and praise the non-whites. That's how they're brought up to believing.
May I ask a question? Don't you people ever get taught about IQ and race?
Well, no, we have to teach ourselves. It won't get taught in like schools or any education system. It's
because that's the thing that I can't understand, that the white girls, you know, don't they understand that their mixed race babies are going to be lower IQ?
No, they're just dumb bimbos. They think, oh, mixed race, it's so cute. And obviously black people have been such victims of what's gone on. They're oppressed. So this is the attitude a lot of people have, European nations.
I would say there's another aspect of it as well, right, where the English men have been made to feel like weak and diminished, right? And women, like, especially schoolgirls, they usually looking for to be protected. So I think, like, as they're growing up, you know, amongst like the popular culture, whether like in rap music and all that sort of stuff, the women tend to go with these blacks, so they feel protected more than, say, a lot of these like weeby white guys. So I'll say that's definitely an effect of it as well.
I want to agree with you on that, because that is definitely the case, that the white male is becoming weaker, weedier, nerdier, geekier, and he's portrayed as a loser, and the black man is strong and he's a leader and all that kind of stuff. And in America, because they're blacks, they got so many blacks that are physically big, or they've been pulled out and chosen and made famous because of their size, they then say, oh, these males are superior. But you know, and everything that the white male was, the white male has been destroyed, and the white male is such a weakling. And I agree with you that, yes, that is that's another important thing for women. Women want to be with strong men. Among the few interracial marriages that are high profile here in South Africa and Southern Africa was the neighboring state of Botswana, which was a British protectorate. There was a black guy called Khama, and when he became the prime minister or the president of it, when it became independent, he was a white woman married him. And actually, in the early days of black rule in Africa, all the black leaders were trying to marry white women. And there were a couple of the presidents that had white wives. And in South Africa, there's a politician known as he's got a strange name, a very strange name. Okay. So his first name is Tokyo, as in the capital of Japan, and his surname is pronounced Sekwale, but it's actually spelt almost like sex whale. So Tokyo Sekwale is the only high-ranking politician I know who had a white woman marry him in the at the end of apartheid. So those things do happen. And those white women clearly are also going for social status, blah, 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 blah. And so, so yes, women go for those things. They want strong men. And yeah, absolutely. And that is also why I believe that white men, white males in particular, must stick together, work together, and hopefully in the decades to come, we're going to form white armies of males, because we need to take the world back. That's what I believe. Absolutely. And that's going to be that to me is the only way to view this thing. But the women are subject to pressures, and it's got to be countered. Of course, if people were taught about race and IQ, that's the one thing that I see that's so missing. Never in our education, even when I was a kid, never were we told where do whites come from. That I had to figure out for myself like 40 years later. Where do we come from? And things like IQ, utterly critical, the achievements of our race, why we should stick together, all those things, none of it is there. We should be doing like the Germans and having like, we need like political and racial education for all whites, so whites understand what's going on. But anyway.
Yeah, I watched a documentary, I can't remember what it was, and there's maybe a few areas in South Africa, but there was this one particular area where it was literally like whites only. It's literally like a little a village of just white people. They all go to clubs together, they all have a great time, and then they you know, some of them have shirts on where it's like white woman and a white man together, you know. Do you know what I'm talking about? Or
okay, there are, you could be talking about Orania. Look, one thing you must understand is that in lots of suburbs, the blacks have not moved en masse into the suburbs. Mm. Many suburbs, the whites, despite the fact that whites are like 9% of the population, in many suburbs, whites can make up 30% of the population, or maybe even half. It all depends on where you go. There are quite a number of places where you can go into a suburb, and I would say you'd even get more than 30% of the population of the suburb, maybe even 50 or 60%. It all depends on where you go, where most of the people in the suburb will be white. There are still such places in South Africa even now. It just depends on where you go. But there are small settlements that are specifically racial. And one of them is called Orania.
Yeah,
and it's a little town of 1,600 people.
All right. So basically, like, obviously it's because it's a mainstream media documentary. They would portray this area as, you know, a Nazi far right fascist, village or little city or town or whatever it is. I don't know if it's a city, town or a village, but they portrayed it as if they're all fascists, they're all Nazis, you know, the labels the mainstream media give. Would that be the same area that you're talking about, do you think?
Yeah, that documentary you're talking about, Chris, that documentary you are talking about is about Orania. I've seen that documentary.
Oh, is
that, like Jan says, there's around, well, you say before the other day when I was watching you, Jan, that there's around, 1,000 to 2,000 people there, and within the last year or something, there was 12,000 people applied to move there, were you saying?
Oh, yes. Orania, basically what happened with Orania is when they started it, it was just a couple of hundred people, and as time has gone by, it's grown to about 1,600. However, I knew a guy, I've been there, and it's quite a nice place, and I actually wanted to go there again, but I knew a guy who lived there who I could speak to on confidential terms, and he said to me that every month now it must be even worse, but he said every month they get 12,000 applications for people to come to Orania. So if that had been allowed, then within a year, Orania would be 100,000 people. But he said that he believed that the government may have put pressure on the people who run Orania so that they don't just take in lots of whites. And there is another place much closer to where I live, because Oranje is far away in the south, but up in Pretoria to the north is another place known as Kleinfontein, which is also a type of Oranje. But, and then what you have is you've got camps of whites only. And in the west of Pretoria, there's a farm where about 500 whites live together on a farm. So you do have these, and there are other people trying to start other tiny little settlements. So there are little bands of whites from the poor and the downtrodden who live in camps to the more affluent who buy houses and live in a place like Oranje. Whites are forming more and more into communities.
Do you actually know any that you're with this Oranje? Sorry if I pronounced it wrong. But what is it? What's the crime statistics there? Is it very obviously? I would presume it's very, very low.
I think you're probably looking at zero.
because just wanted to clarify for the audience.
let me just tell you how do they do it, because you've got to understand. You cannot have a community on a racial basis, as that would be a crime. Okay. If we said that only whites can live here, then that would be a crime. So the way that they get around it is they form it as a business. So they form it as a business, and the business has got a whole bunch of requirements and rules and money that you've got to pay into it, et cetera, et cetera. So they've worked out like a method of doing it so that it's legal, and that they don't say that no, we chase the blacks out, we discriminate against them, so that the blacks don't really want to go there, etc., etc. So they run it as a business, and that's how they manage to get around it. So it's quite a tricky thing. The whites in South Africa, by the way, make a lot of use of their language of Afrikaans as a means of also managing to push some of these non-whites away from them. So they use their language also and their culture as a way of like getting a bit of space, and they use it very effectively. They're very clever about that.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. I mean, like, I think that's something maybe we should do in England, to have maybe an area where our people can collectivise together. I think that's a possibility, because I actually don't think there's a political solution. Would you agree with that, Jan? There's no political solution in your country as well as ours?
There is no political solution. What I will say as well, I'm going to put out a video. I've already completed it. But I'm going to put out a video about Professor Quigley. When I put out the video about Professor Quigley and how the American elite think, you really must watch it. I think you guys will immediately see all kinds of things fall into place in a way that you've never seen before. This was something I dug into quite a lot. So I will be putting it up. Obviously, these interviews where we're discussing the current violence, these are going to take precedence. But Quigley's video will go up, and don't miss it. I'll also try to remember to notify you. But because you need to see the thinking behind it, because once you understand what Quigley is saying, then you'll actually maybe understand why they are flooding your country. Believe it or not, there is some kind of logic, but I don't want to discuss the logic here. Maybe we can do that as a separate show. I think first you should see what Quigley is about, because Quigley was an academic who did various lectures, and he was very well connected. Anyway, my own belief is that you know, we've got a top-down problem. We've actually got a class problem, in that the elite have already decided the future, and the elite have decided that the future of the West is going to be some kind of mixed race thing. Yeah. Now, exactly how they arrived at this is a topic of debate. And I myself have wondered whether they've learned all the wrong lessons from Africa. But, But whatever it is, the rich and the powerful are driving this, and they are driving it properly, as you can see, by way of adverts, by way of TV. Somehow money is making all of this happen, and money is also being taken away from the white right. Anyone who's patriotic, anyone who's conservative, demonetized, kicked off. So it should be clear that this is a class issue. This is elites who've decided to sideline their own people. And I personally think that the only way out of this is, I personally think the only thing really is revolution, actually. I think the only historical method of stopping this is to create, first of all, culture and values for whites, and then for all whites everywhere to stick together, and then for all whites everywhere to work together until we can start breaking somebody free. Somebody's got to break out and take back some piece of land somewhere in the Western world. I think that this is a class thing, that you've got traitors working with super rich, and these traitors and super rich and others have decided to sideline their own people for whatever reasons, and that they don't care about drowning them out. And they also believe, what I will tell you from Quigley is this, they believe they are creating a new and stronger civilization, believe it or not. But I personally disagree. I don't believe that interpretation. Let me just finish. I firmly believe that the way that the Germans were thinking, the Germans and the Axis powers were thinking, they were dead right. They were on the path of what is the strongest civilization. And we need to all go back to sticking together, totally.
Yeah, you know, with the German question, the wills, I don't think that's something we need to be talking to the British people, because it's such a, obviously, even if Hitler was right or whatever, yeah, I don't think we should be talking to your everyday English person about, oh, Hitler was right. You know, if we're going to talk about the Jews, then I think we should talk about the modern day Jays, like their overrepresentation in media, pornography, banking, all this. I don't think we need to go back and try and educate the English people. Say, you know what, your granddad actually died for Jews. I don't agree with that. Like, I mean, that's my opinion. I don't think we should be touching the World War II narrative here, especially in the UK with what's going on between Germany and England, even though, you know, Winston Churchill was a Zionist. I just think it needs to be left alone. We need to look at the here and now and the future.
I mean, if people want to talk about a war, right, they should talk about World War One, because British people are less attached to World War One emotionally. But there's just as much involvement in World War One with God's chosen people as there was in World War Two. As a strategic strategy, I'd advise people to talk about World War One if they want to talk about a war all the time.
Do you think TV's a great game changer for the elites, Jan? Because they never ever had a weapon like that before, did they?
Absolutely, you're dead on the money. You know, TV and radio and mass propagandization one way. I think that was a major killer for them, and that's also why there's more and more censorship on the internet, because they don't want counter narratives. So it's for our survival. The first and foremost thing for our survival as a race is the movement of knowledge and data and history, and uniting all whites together. If we don't continue, you know, these things that you guys are doing, this is the most critical task of all. If you stop doing this, then the upper classes will win. And the only proper method of countering them is to counter them, to fight fire with fire. When they put out their lies, you've got to counter it. And I want to tell you that when I die of old age and I'm not doing this, You'll have to be busy doing this. People will have to be busy doing this after you. We've got to do this because if we don't build our culture and our cultural and racial identity and knowledge, then we will die. We will be destroyed. We will be destroyed then.
Yeah. So obviously we've now set up our organization here in the UK, which I'll put in the chat here. We got, by the way, we've got a show tomorrow just for any newcomers, and there's a few people that's joined us. We have a show tomorrow, 7 to 8, with Richard Lumby, former BNP and former PA, and Anglo Joe, also former PA, and myself, and we'll be talking about Independent Nationalist Network tomorrow, and getting some ideas across. And also, you're welcome to put your ideas in. So I'll put some links in the chat as well. But over to you, Jan. Have you got any good suggestions for what people can do, like activism wise, within their own communities, or around the country? What would be your suggestion for us English? By the way, make sure you know that we do have hate speech rules. What could the British people do to probably wake up more British people to the demographic replacement of our people? Or anything you want to add? So just what's your suggestions on the activism that we could do?
Okay, in terms of activism, one question that I've asked people over and over the years, whenever I run into people in South Africa, in America, everywhere, wherever I go and wherever I meet people and whenever I talk to people, I ask white people, what is it that brought you to this point where you understand these racial issues or these historical issues? And regardless of who I've spoken to, the one thing I've found is that many things, many and varied things trigger the red pilling process. That some people are triggered by 9/11. Some people are triggered by the Holocaust. Some people are triggered by, race or IQ or something. And what I found, but here's what I'm getting to, is that the trigger can be one of 100 or 1,000 different things. But once whites are triggered, once white people understand, for example, I have a German friend, and he told me when he was young, he was red-pilled in the 60s by the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And all these people give me different answers, but here's the important part. Regardless of what triggers them, the moment that a white person realizes that he's been lied to on a grand scale about something. In other words, let's say he studied 9/11 and he eventually says, good God, they lied about this, they lied about that, this isn't so, that isn't so, or whatever. And once he understands one lie, then the next thing that happens is he says, but if I've been lied to on a big scale once, then wasn't I lied to about other things? And then their minds go open and they start looking for other things. And then they become skeptical about other things. And I, for example, spoke to a lady here in South Africa who was a good supporter of mine. And she said to me that I said to her, how long did it take you from being liberal to being racial? She said 3 years. So 3 years earlier, she was a total believing liberal, and now she's racial and she knows about Jews and everything. And I found that once you can red pill somebody on anything, that is the way to get them that's the trigger for everything. And you know what? All paths will eventually lead to the same place. Eventually, everybody will end up with the Jewish issue, etc. So it doesn't matter what you red pill them on. So what I'm saying is that if you're going to do activism, do activism to focus on people's minds and look at what they're susceptible to. And if you see, for example, you might know somebody and okay, like you say, don't talk about World War II. Let's talk about 9/11. Then you red pill them on 9/11, and that will be what will work for them. And from there onwards, you go. And you see, also the more data we have, like now you've got COVID. COVID itself has given us new things to red pull people on.
Sorry, John. I think COVID's massive. I think that's a massive win for us in a way. And also, I don't know how bad it was in South Africa, but the Black Lives, it probably is actually, but Black Lives Matter riots across the globe with George Floyd's death probably done more for the nationalist cause than anyone on this panel and outside the panel has ever done, to be fair. I think the Black Lives Matter riots really, really helped us last year, to be honest.
No, I have to 100% agree with you say there, Chris, like, especially with the Black Lives Matter stuff, but with the COVID stuff as well, what Jan was just talking about, it's definitely the right time to go in there and red people on other stuff. Like, they know something's up, but they can't directly put their finger on everything. Yes. And another thing I would say as well, right, is we should be everything to everyone, right? So, you know, maybe learn a bit of Christianity and learn some of the racial verses in Christianity, if you believe in it or not, right? You know, start to make these environmental arguments that immigration is bad for the environment, or these animal rights arguments that halal and kosher meat are bad. It's not the European way that we do stuff. Or another thing is, I would say, is push to ban male circumcision. You know, this is not a European thing either. But sorry, John, back to you, mate.
Nice. No, excellent. And all I'm saying to you is if you focus on knowledge and red pilling, everything else will follow. Because once people realize that they've been lied to, and I do agree with you, Mercian, I do agree, don't drive people away. Stick to bringing everybody in our race together. I try to bring Christians and atheists together, and I tell each one what I think about the situation. And I tell Christians, I don't agree with this, but we're a race and we've got to stick together, and that race is more important, you know. So, you know, once you get people to think correctly, everything else will follow. The politics will follow. The movements will follow. People will start getting irritated by things. Other people will do protest marches. Others will go into politics. Others, you know, but first you've got to open their minds. And once you've done that, all whites are basically truth seekers, and they take the truth seriously. So once they understand firmly that they've been lied to about one thing, from there onwards, you won't even have to teach them anything else. They'll find it themselves. I'm telling you, it'll be fast. And nowadays, there's so much data out there, books that have been written, videos that have been done, and you must create more. And this quality stuff just feeds into people. And once people get red-pilled, they quickly start looking for things. They grab it. They digest it. They digest it fast. And they move forward at a hell of a pace, actually. So if you red pill people, that's the best way to change everything, because then the culture will change.
Yeah,
I'll say this as well, right? On this subject, right? Before you move on, Chris. One thing a nationalist don't tend to realize is some people you need to wake up by emotion. Like, we're very good at making these facts and logical arguments, right? But yeah, like, just to reiterate the point that you have to find out what people are emotionally attached to and make these emotional arguments to wake certain people up, especially women, I would say. But go ahead, Chris.
Oh, yeah. No, I wanted to, like, I don't know how much you was aware, obviously, we had the European Championships. It's a massive footballing event. We know that England's very multicultural right now, and obviously they allowed three black Africans to take the penalties and lost, you know, which is kind of a blessing, so we don't have to hear the trash that diversity won England a championship. Wanting to know your thoughts behind this football, because I think it's important to still go attend football events, you know, like when they're taking the knee, you know, or sporting events, when they're taking a knee, if there's a good group of you and you're booing it, and then people ask you, well, why are you booing it? And then we can say, like, well, these guys looted and rioted and attacked our people across our capital city mainly and burnt our flag. You can red pill people that way. So what's your thoughts on people still supporting sporting events, even though the team might be multicultural? I'm talking more about the supporters that are still your people, yes, that you need to wake up. That's my aim, to be honest.
If I don't attack people for the things that they do. Like a lot of whites, even in South Africa, even in America, they are very clingy with regard to sport. But eventually, even in South Africa, where like rugby was the big thing, eventually whites, I don't know if they're that attached to sport anymore as they used to be. You know, I must tell you that in the long run, everything that's linked to money, you'll find that everything that's linked to money is against us, but people will have to learn it bit by bit. In time here in South Africa, all the racial stuff over sport pissed lots of people off. And I don't know if they're that attentive to it as they were. But in your case, where you're thinking of going there and trying to do something to talk to people and red pill people, any method that you use to get to people is fine. I think it's great. I'm not gonna chide you because you go there, you know.
But do you still think we should support our nation? Like, do you still think we should support our nation? Like, I was around like every week or every few days around 50, 60 white Englishmen that wanted England to win. You know, I was always booed, taking a knee. You know, I was a bit gutted when like Raheem Sterling scored, who was Jamaican, by the way. But do you not think these things are important? Just still support your nation over another nation. And especially from an audience perspective, you know, like there was loads of people on Telegram, for instance, that were celebrating England losing the final. But when they were celebrating, I was surrounded by 50 white English men and girls crying and fighting and being upset. You know, they're our people. We need to make friends with them and try and bring them over to our side the best we can.
I think if your purpose is to make friends with them and bring them over, do that. Use any method that brings them closer to you so that you can talk to them. I have no problem with that. But you got to understand, like I don't particularly support South Africa anymore. I only think in racial terms. But I do understand white South Africans and how to get to white South Africans. But ultimately, I don't see this as my country. And I think you must be careful that you must realize that your country is slipping away from under your feet. You know, the rug is being pulled out from under your feet. But whatever tactics you use to get to people, is anything's okay. You know, even if you go and pretend you're a Christian just to go and talk to some people, do whatever. Yeah, but, you know, my view is do whatever you need to do to win people over. Get, befriend them, win their trust, bring them close, yes. And then turn them racial, please.
Some good things you can do at the football, right? So one guy, when this Black Lives Matter stuff was going on, he hired a plane out and flew a banner over one of the football games. It was live on Sky Sports, right? So that went well. The sign that said "White Lives Matter." Also, a lot of the football fans are pissed off with this.
Wonderful.
There's a thing where they take the knee before the games in honor of this George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. So a lot of the fans in the recent Euros were booing this, right? It would be great if someone could get a chant off in one of these stands that said, like, fuck BLM, fuck BLM, or whatever, in like the football style chants. I think that's something that could do. And also, Chris himself has been going outside football stadiums with White Lives Matter signs, right? Now, he was doing it in COVID, but if people could get down to football stadiums when they're packed and you can get a picture with all these people behind this banner, even if they don't necessarily agree with the message, right, that would be powerful to spread around as for propaganda purposes, I believe. So there's some ideas people can do with it. Go on, Jan.
Something I'd like to add. When I was in America, I met a group called the European Heritage Association, and those guys do wonderful stuff in America by putting up stickers and plaque, and they walk around and they'll put a sticker on a you know, in a road which says, you know, like White Lives Matter or anything. They've got a whole bunch of stuff that they put up that they just walk around and they just plaster stickers all over the town and city that's got some kind of message for whites, really nice messages. And that seemed to me to be also excellent activism. They really seem to do well.
What do you think about other people make the suggestion that sometimes it's better for – it wakes a lot more people up when they see an anti-white message rather than a pro-white message, right?
You're getting – sorry. You're getting into clarify that a bit more.
So what do you think about some people
just suggest – elaborate
So some people suggest like stuff like Black Lives Matter, right? Or when people see these anti-white messages. I mean, there's other groups of people out there that suggest they should be accelerating the left. So when they're pushing like this critical race theory, instead of like opposing it, you should let them push it more because it eventually will wake people up at a quicker rate.
Okay. Yes, there are some things which if you leave the enemy alone, the enemy creates such a backlash, like this critical race theory. This critical race theory has been pissing people off. But I would think that from our side, we just want to focus on positive stuff that bring people to us. Don't worry too much about what, you know, just try and expose the enemy. I think that's the best way I can answer you, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, that's fine, John. Sorry, Chris.
That's fine. Oh, we've got 12 minutes. If you guys want in the chat want to get any questions in, please put them in now because we've got like 10 minutes to go. I'm sure
I had one last question. I'd just like to get your thoughts on what do you think is to come for South Africa in the short term and maybe in the long term, if you want to go into that, Jan.
You're thinking what is coming? In the short term, I don't think that there's going to be any other violence that's going to occur. If it occurs, it's very minor. The long term, I see the breakup of South Africa, and I see that as a good thing. I see the balkanization of South Africa and possible breakup. And the more I look at this Zuma Ramaphosa thing and information that's come out from there, I think the breakup of the political party, the ANC, is going to be a good thing. It could end up with very strange bedfellows, possibly. I also think that for the whites of South Africa, it's a long path forward, but I think that path is definitely a path towards sticking together. And I actually hope that the breakup of South Africa takes place in my lifetime. I hope it happens sooner rather than later, because I think awesome things are possible. What we almost need in the world today is we almost need another pariah white nation. We need another Rhodesia or another South Africa that is a country that breaks the rules and it's busy and it maybe is pissing off the rest of the West and the elite. But by being able to break the rules and do its own thing, it galvanizes the rest of our population and our people into action. And in that sense, what I'm kind of saying is that if it should be that there is some kind of war in South Africa in the future and whites are busy fighting for their existence, that sort of thing should be a good catalyst for other whites to then be even more active in their countries and to spread the message that, you know, what those whites are going through is actually what's coming to us. And, you know, we need to all stick together. We've got to stick together.
Okay, I'm going to move on to some questions. Dan Twig has said, do you think Europe / South Africa will end up in a full-blown anarchy because of all this? And what do you think the longer-term outcomes will be?
Just did you say Europe / South Africa?
Yeah, that's what he said in the question. Do you think Europe / South Africa, yeah.
Do I think it will end in a race war?
In full-blown anarchy, because of all this that's going on? And what do you, no. What do you think the longer term outcomes will be?
Let me tell you how things really work. Things, a lot of things that you think that things just explode into violence. Lots of whites think like that, but that's not how it actually works. In actual fact, most things, when they start exploding into violence, you get other whites and you even get lots of whites who go and try to calm things down and stop it. So violence is only something that comes when you have somebody who's organized and determined to do something. So I don't think so. There's none of this is spontaneous. And nothing that ever happens in any country is spontaneous. It is only when you have like a political party or a movement that determines that it's going to do something, let's say seize a piece of territory, that you will now get to a point where you have real ongoing violence and war. So I think things will quieten down. But I think as time goes by, as the years go by, we'll see more lawlessness. We'll also see the state losing more and more control of South Africa. And that will be good because I think eventually parts of South Africa might break away. I think that a possibility might be that the Zulus might in time to come might even want to secede from South Africa. And the hatred between the Zulus and the Indians, I see it as a good thing. I think division is coming to South Africa, and in the long term, we will end up with some kind of war. We will have some kind of civil war at some point, whether it's 5 years or 10 years or 15 or 20 years, but I think some kind of civil war is coming.
Interesting. So just moving on quickly, we have only 7 minutes left. What does
I have a quick one.
Go on. I'll let you have it.
I have a quick one. It's on a lighter note, Jan. I don't really know the context of this one. What are your thoughts on Kevin Peterson?
Who?
I've never heard the name. He's
a South African guy that plays cricket for England.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Yeah, what's your thoughts on
you how little I take notice of these. I don't even follow these.
I was asked the question. I thought perhaps you had like some history with Kevin Peterson, but yeah, obviously you don't. No problem.
God, yeah, and he was in England team as well, weren't he? He was actually in England team, cricket team.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your thoughts on South Africa versus the British Lions? I think that's what they call them.
I don't watch the sport and I don't care. I've switched off. I don't switch on my TV or my radio ever.
He's actually quite funny. I like Kevin Peterson, though, to be fair.
I mean, that's what Dr. William Pierce says, right? Not to turn the jukebox on, right?
Let's move on. Go on. Say your piece, bro.
It irritates me intensely. I'd want to throw a brick through it every freaking hour.
Yeah, try being a Birmingham City supporter. We're like that every Saturday. But what does Jan think about global homogenization as a concept to explain what is going on?
You mean, just explain what you mean by global homogenization? You mean... Do you think that what is happening is natural? Let me ask you that question. Do you think it's a natural thing that's taking place? Because I say it's a manufactured thing. It's something that elites are creating. It's not a thing that's happening by accident. So let me tell you something. Every time, like communism, the original communists, the Soviet Union, they set out to conquer the world and turn the world into communist states. And in actual fact, what they ended up creating was all the people of all the different races on the different continents ended up wanting nation states. Nationalism is the norm. Racialism is the norm. If you give blacks and others choices, they will become racial. Maybe not to the same extent as we do, but ultimately, race is real and nations are also a real factor. And when it comes to globalism, globalism is a junk idea. And diversity and bringing everybody together under one roof, that's a junk idea. And even the non-whites start going down that path. Like here with the Indians shooting the blacks then started calling the Indians racists. They said, oh, they're these racists. They're these racists. So, you know, that is why the more chaotic this situation becomes, the more weird it's going to be, and the more the liberal sort of ideas will just break down, and people will see them for the stupid, hypocritical, junk ideas that they really are. That's why chaos is good. It starts messing up that nice, neat, liberal paradigm that used to exist when we only watched TV. Let things roll along. That game breaks by itself.
Do you think the elites have had to push a few of their plans forward a few years? Because some of this stuff that they're rolling out now, it seems like the general populace aren't quite ready for them yet, are they?
You know, this is a very interesting topic. Other people have raised it as well. I've also wondered about it, but I can't say it for sure. One thing I do think is that the elite are scared, and you can see that with their censorship, their draconian censorship, and the many weird things they do. Look at that stolen election in America. There was something freaking weird. They were desperate to get Trump out, even though Trump's not that good, but they were absolutely desperate, so desperate that they rigged their own election. So that also was a good thing. So, you know, that's why the more we push our message, you'll see that they will hit back themselves. But there are times, many times also when they hit back, especially nowadays, they also make many mistakes. So don't always think that the enemy does it right. Do what you can, push your message across. The enemy can sometimes make big mistakes. Even these blacks who are doing things, they make huge mistakes. They make huge mistakes that will benefit whites in the long run.
All right, so we're going to end the show now. Obviously, in the next couple of minutes, we'll get some final thoughts from everyone. We have an after show on Brit Talk. Mercy, just put that in the chat if you can do it again. I'll give my final thoughts very shortly. Let's go to Hemi. Anything you want to add? Anything you want to plug? Anything you want to say to Jan? Yeah, anything you want to say, bro?
I'll just do a bit of plug-in. Remember, 37 on Telegram, and it's JD, and it's JD Lee on Thursday.
So I have to silence that nonsense. We censor that crap. We're not 37. We're 40. Let's get some 40s in the chat, guys.
37 gang gang. 37 gang gang.
By the way, to the audience as well, did you enjoy the show? Put one in the chat if you enjoy it, put two if you didn't. Let's get some ones or 14s or 40s. Definitely no 37s. We don't like the 37, do we? But Mercian, over to you. Final thoughts, anything you want to say, anything you want to plug. You know, if you want to propose to Hemi, go ahead, do what you want, bro.
No, I just want to thank Jan for coming on and for a great show tonight, and we'll see everyone next week, right? So I'll keep it short and sweet, mate.
Thank you very much. Jan, over to you, sir. Please spend a couple of minutes talking about anything you want. Praise us, of course. If you want to give us a praise, we'll send you some rupees. But no, honestly, pleasure hosting you on the show tonight, sir. And the platform is yours. Please go ahead, promote whatever you want, say whatever you want. Over to you, Jan.
Okay, my website is historyreviewed.com and africancrisis.info. It's an honor being on your show, and I'm really glad to see some people in Britain trying to do something. I do understand that you guys have got a lot of difficult rules that you've got to contend with, but hang in there. My main hope is that you'll push race ultimately, because we've got to get beyond the other things that are problematic for us, because we've got to survive as a group. And maybe all these non-whites and diversity will ultimately lead to unity among white people on a scale that we've never had before, where we don't worry too much about other junk because we've got other bigger problems. And I also do think that the fact that lots of whites in different countries are facing similar problems now will also ultimately bring us together. And you will see that race is real and differences are real. Those differences that don't seem so big, they are big. And I will tell you something else that I've not mentioned to you. And that is that when times are good, like now, where life is still relatively okay, you can coexist with your multiracial, with the other diversity peoples. But as times get harder, you will find that your stresses will build up much more and more and more. I actually think that in many ways, liberalism is actually creating a situation for the greatest and bloodiest racial conflict in the history of the world, because they are introducing, take for example, Britain and Europe, they're introducing complexities into your country over and above the complexities that you already had. You had, let's say, Welsh, Irish, Scottish, English. Now they're bringing in all kinds of other things. And rest assured, this additional complexity, also with different viewpoints and different boundaries, will lead to all kinds of problems that you have not had in Britain maybe in 1,000 or 2,000 years, you know. So the same is going to happen to Europe. And some places in Europe, like Sweden and so forth, where the whites have been really, where everything's been really nice and soft and all organized, those whites are going to discover that they're going to live in a nightmare with problems that they never had before and never believed could exist. And unfortunately, white people need to have things come to their doorstep. And that's the good part about this. Them bringing all these non-whites in everywhere, I assure you that in history, let's say 500 years from now, people will look back on this time and they'll say, these people were so stupid. They were so fucking stupid. How could they let this happen? Couldn't they see what it would lead to, and that it would lead to bloodshed and all kinds of things? But the elite, you see, one thing I'll say about the elite as a final point. The elite of the West, in my view, and you'll see this with Quigley, the elite of the West believe that they can rule non-whites and whites. Mm. And they're just interested in power. But in so doing, they've kicked the whites, their own kith and kin, they've kicked them straight in the teeth. And I think that this will ultimately backfire on them. So, you know, you're living in an experiment, but don't ever be depressed and despondent. Just work for white unity. Even if you are outnumbered, whites will still come through. I lived in Rhodesia. We were at a point, we were less than 5% of the population. We still dominated even militarily. So don't ever quit, even as your numbers go down. In fact, as your numbers go down, whites will probably become tighter and tighter and work together more and more. We have got tremendous potential, and you are far from dead. So don't quit. We in South Africa is 9%. I will tell you, we are still not finished. So you've got lots ahead of you. Just keep going and don't let the enemy bring your spirits down. Don't let them break you.
Thank you very much, John. We need to end the show now. We're running over time, but I just want to say thank you to Martin. Thank you to Hemi, but especially thank you to you, Jan. You gave us a great insight on what his life is like over in Africa through the last few weeks and a bit of a history behind it. So thank you very much. This show will be uploaded to Odyssey maybe tonight or definitely tomorrow. There's a link in the chat. Go and subscribe. We will be also doing an after show in Telegram. Marcion, no, I've got it. Yeah, if you want to join on the after show, you're welcome to have your say to any of us on the show. I don't think Jan will be involved, but I will. The host will be involved anyway, so you can come and have your say. Tomorrow night, we will be back 7 till 8 o'clock. We will be with former BNP and former PA, former BNP and former PA officer Richard Lombe and Anglo Joe, where we'll be discussing our new organisation, Independent Nationalist Network. Anyone can join, even if you're PA, Britain First. Anyone can join. It's just about working within your own community and just advising you what to do. You know, there's no leaders as such, but please join us here. That's the link there. And we also have an open chat if you want to put your ideas forward. But there's no rules really as such. Obviously, keep it quite optical, but there's no ID checks. And we're just going to advise you to do stuff in your own area. I think it's a good movement to follow, especially those that don't want to pass a handover identification to PA, which also I'm not digging at them. I understand why they're wanting to do it, because this is a more grassroots movement than Patriotic Alternative. So please support us as well. Hope you enjoy the show, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure to host Jan. We will bring Jan back probably in the next 3-4 weeks to talk about other topics. So hopefully you accept that offer, Jan. I know I like to do my final last thoughts, but just give a final goodbye, Jan. Make it very brief and I'll play the outro. So say whatever you want. Say your goodbyes to the audience, to the British audience, Jan. Over to you.
Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate you people listening to me and giving me a chance to talk. And I hope we can have some more shows together. Looking forward to it. And thank you so much, Chris, for your invitation. I really appreciated it. Glad to see there are people in Britain that haven't given up.
We will never give up, mate. We'll never give up. Thank you very much, Jan. Thank you, Hemi. Thank you, Mercy. Please join us on Brit Talk right now. We will do the after show as we play the music out. And please join us 7 p.m. tomorrow. Hope you all have a lovely Monday evening, guys. And we'll see you soon. Peace out. Oh, by the way, if you're new, we're on Mondays every single week, 7 till 9 GMT. So please stay around. We've got no guests lined up yet next Monday. But check out my channels, Brit Talk and Chris Patriot Talk, and we'll reveal the guests there. So please stay with us. I hope you enjoy the show, guys. Write whatever number you want in the chat, 14 especially. And just fuck 37. I love you all, guys. We'll see you very soon. And see you in Brit Talk afterwards. Peace out.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.